For today are available on this link here on the Blackboard, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I've posted my slides and then also there's a link to a notebook that we'll be using a little bit later on today. If you don't have TensorFlow installed, that's completely okay. We're gonna do it through Google Collaboratory, so I'm gonna walk you through how to do that a little bit later. You don't need to worry about that notebook yet, but as long as you have access to Google Drive through some Gmail account, you'll be fine. You don't need to install anything. Okay, so today I'm just gonna give an introduction to machine learning and talk about the TensorFlow library within Python. If any of you attended the PSI course that we have on machine learning from Anybody Physics, there'll be some overlap here, although I've tried to make this talk a little bit more general without so many applications to many-body physics, but a little bit more general introduction. Okay, so to start, to just give kind of some motivation, I like to just start by, I always go to Google Trends and just kind of look at how machine learning has been growing in popularity over the last few years. So I actually just did this last night. So you can see that since 2015, there's been a huge increase in how interested people are in this field, although it has been around for longer than those years. And that's not just in physics. So I kind of want to actually start by talking to you a little bit about machine learning more generally, and then specifically talk about applications to physics. But first of all, I think it's important to know in kind of general terms what machine learning is. So I like to kind of ask the audience what you guys already know about it. So if someone were to ask you what machine learning is in just, you know, one sentence or something, does anyone have something that they would say? Anyone? Yeah?
Best thing I've heard is that it's statistics done on a Mac.
Say that again?
Statistics done on a Mac.
Statistics done on a Mac. Cool, yeah. Statistics is very important. And yeah, computers, very important too, yeah. Anything else? Anything that comes to mind when you hear the word machine learning?
Fancy regression method.
Yeah, cool. I like that a lot. That's good. I always say that if the course was called like fitting with nonlinear functions, the attendance would be like less than half of what it is when you call it machine learning. But yeah, that's good. Yeah, so these are just a couple of definitions that you can find if you look. So the first one is just from Wikipedia. So it's a field that uses statistical techniques to give computer systems the ability to learn without being explicitly programmed. So we heard some of those words. So statistics is important. It's about using computers. And in some way, we want to teach them to learn something. What we really mean by that is we don't really hard code in the rules, and we give it some ability to figure out what those rules on its own. And I like this second quote. This is from a physicist. Machine learning is about finding regularities in data and making use of them for fun and profit. Nice use of machine learning there. So the next thing that kind of general that I think is important is that when you tend to hear about machine learning, you tend to hear about a lot of different words like artificial intelligence, neural networks, deep learning. These kind of buzzwords all kind of tend to be floated around and sometimes used interchangeably. But they're actually, you can think of them as a Venn diagram. So machine learning is really a type of artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
but
second.
Oh yeah.
People on Zoom complaining that your microphone is muted. It's not muted.
No.
If the AV team is listening, can you
okay.
Correct that? No one answers. Let's hope they heard it anyway.
Maybe they're muted too. Okay. I'll keep going, but yeah, let me know if I should stop. So when we say more, when we speak more broadly about artificial intelligence, what we really mean is computers that can mimic human intelligence in some way. Machine learning specifically refers, the key word here is really learning. So giving computers the ability to learn. So instead of explicitly giving them rules, we give them this ability to learn. So that's really the big difference between those two. Then neural networks, we're going to talk a lot more about those today, but those are really a specific type of algorithm that we can use to do machine learning. So this is just an example of one. I'm going to show you more examples throughout today's session. And deep learning, this is really a type of a class of algorithms within neural networks, and it just refers to how many layers that we have within our network. So as we add more layers to these neural networks, we start to talk about deep learning. Okay, so now I'm just going to talk quickly just about some ways that machine learning has advanced many different areas. Some of these are maybe obviously have relationships to physics or ways that we can easily apply them within physics, and maybe others are for some other areas. So the first one, image classification. So there is a test that goes out every year that has a series of many images, and the challenge is to design some kind of a computer algorithm that can classify these images. And so in 2012, people started using deep convolutional neural networks, and they saw huge advancements in how well they could classify images. And one thing in physics, we can often format our data in a form that will be similar to an image. So this is definitely something that can be very useful for applications in physics. Another thing you may have heard about in the news a few years back is this AlphaGo game. So this is a game that's much, much more difficult than chess. So even though chess was able to beat, computers that play chess were able to beat humans for many, many years, Go was not the same until 2016. And at this point, this AlphaGo system, which was based on reinforcement learning, was able to beat the world's leading champion in Go 4-1. So the way that this algorithm worked, it actually took input from human games of Go, and it was able to generate an algorithm that could do much better. But then, a year later, a new program called AlphaGo Zero was introduced, and this one uses actually zero human input. So that's what it refers to when it says tabula rasa here. It means it doesn't start from any input from humans. And this was even able to perform much, much better than the original algorithm from the year previously. So this game that is extremely difficult is able to be mastered by computers by making use of reinforcement learning and neural networks. Another application that's if I ask people what they think of with machine learning, if it's a lot of applications that come to mind often have to do with self-driving cars. So this is one you might have heard about a lot that people are working on using machine learning to develop self-driving cars. It's also enabled huge advances in language translation. So you can look up articles that will show how Google Translate worked to translate certain passages before this kind of breakthrough in 2016. And it's really amazing to see. So basically, they started relying more on neural networks at this time, and they saw huge improvements in how well language could be translated. Something kind of fun, you can also use machine learning to generate art. So this is a website you can just go to and use for free. So I put in a picture of Perimeter Institute, and I chose the style here in step two. It'll output a new image for you. So you can do this with any pictures that you might have. Generate your own art. This is just another artist who uses machine learning to generate his artwork. So these are just a couple of his works. This is a really neat website if you want to go to it. thispersondoesnotexist.com. This uses general adversarial networks, and it actually generates pictures of people just in real time. Every time you refresh the page, it's a new person, but none of these people are real people. So it's kind of interesting to keep seeing all the different options that you can get if you go there. So this was developed in 2018, but it was actually released in 2019 for the public. So another really exciting application of machine learning is in medical diagnosis. So this specific paper actually showed that for diagnosing pneumonia, convolutional neural networks were able to do better than practicing radiologists. And there's other applications in medicine as well, but this is just one in particular that's exciting. And now I want to talk about a few different applications for physics. So the first one that I've put up here, this is actually a paper from 2014, so a few years back. And so machine learning has actually been used within high energy physics and particle physics for a very long time. And in this paper in particular, it wasn't the first time that they were using machine learning, but they were really illustrating the power of deep learning here. So in making these networks more deep, and they were able to show that this is able to improve the power of collider searches for exotic particles. And of course, this field has been continuing to advance since then, but it's a field that lends itself very well to machine learning since there's such huge amounts of data. Another thing that people use machine learning for in physics is for searching for new materials that have some desired properties. So in this paper, they're just outlining a procedure where you can use machine learning to search for new materials that have some kind of desirable properties.
Sorry, they're fixing the sound on Zoom. The video switch.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. There we go.
Participants will be happy about that.
There we go. Yeah. That's okay. Yeah, okay. And then the last applications I kind of want to touch on before I kind of get into more details about how we implement this is actually some that are going on within quantum many-body physics and with some researchers here at the Perimeter Institute. So this is work that I talk about more when we teach the machine learning for many-body physics course within the PSI program. So back in 2016, Juan Carrasquilla and Roger Melko, both of whom were at Perimeter at the time, Juan is now in Toronto, they were some of the first people to apply machine learning to quantum condensed matter physics. And what they did is they used this to detect phases of matter and phase transitions in systems. And this field has continued to grow significantly since that time. Another thing that Roger Melko's group is doing is they now work on something called unsupervised learning, which I'll define for you in a few minutes. And they developed an open source software package that they called Cucumber, which stands for Quantum Calculator Used for Many-Body Eigenstate Reconstruction. And so what this does is it uses neural networks, and specifically it relies a lot on a type of architecture known as restricted Boltzmann machines in order to reconstruct wave functions and create models of quantum wave functions. So I'm not going to talk so much about this in particular today, but I'll provide you guys with some resources in case you want to read more about any of these applications. So here I'm giving you a list of resources, and you guys should have these slides available to you. These are just some articles that I find useful. The first two are not specific for physics, but they're really useful for getting used to the idea of what neural networks and deep learning are. The next few are kind of really nice review articles for how machine learning can be used in physics and the physical sciences. So I would really encourage you to look at those if you're maybe interested in a specific area. You can kind of read about applications and relevant articles. The next two are kind of specific review articles more to certain fields. There's of course, more. These are just kind of two that I've come across that I think are good. So the first is kind of a review of how deep learning is used in particle physics, and the second one is specifically for understanding quantum states and this unsupervised learning in Roger Melko's group. So you can read a little bit more of a summary about that. The last point here, this is a really great website to go to. It's maintained by Anna Golubeva, who's a PhD student here. And on there, you can find a list of relevant papers of how machine learning is being used in physics. So there's so many papers now. As we saw in the first slide, this field is really growing. So here, there's a collection of articles that are considered to be quite good and relevant. So I'd encourage you to look there again if you're maybe interested in how machine learning can be applied to a certain field of physics. You'll find a lot of different things you can read there. Does anyone have questions so far? That's just a quick overview of machine learning in physics, but also in many different fields of research. So now I want to kind of talk a little bit more about technical details and work up to the point where we can do this tutorial that I've sent you. So to just give you a few definitions, first of all, machine learning, as we already kind of talked about on the first few slides, what it involves is training computers to detect and characterize some kind of features from data. And a way I also like to think about this is learning to recognize macroscopic features from measurements or from data, which is often microscopic and very large. And so people tend to think of machine learning in three different categories, supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning. So I'm just going to talk in pretty broad terms about what each of those is. So supervised learning, the most important thing here is that we have a data set with labels. So the data set consists of data points that I call X and labels Y. And the goal here is basically to fit some function to these labels so that given some input, we can have a good prediction of what the label should be. Unsupervised learning involves unlabeled data. And so here, what our goal is to basically efficiently represent in some way the underlying probability distribution of this data. And maybe find ways of clustering that data in some smart way that kind of shows us what the important features are, or maybe allows us to generate new samples from this data set, something like that. Reinforcement learning, this is another really large area which is leading to a lot of exciting breakthroughs in research. In this case, you don't really have a data set in the same way. You start with some kind of an environment that's defined, and you take actions with that environment such that the resulting reward is going to be maximized. So today, I'm really only going to talk about supervised learning, and specifically how you can do supervised learning with neural networks. So again, remembering that hierarchy, we're going to be focusing on the supervised learning category of machine learning and thinking about neural network algorithms, although it's not the only type of algorithm. So before I talk about what a neural network is, I just wanted to give a couple examples of supervised learning. So supervised learning can itself be divided into a couple of different categories, depending on whether your labels are continuous or discrete. So if your labels are continuous, we can think of supervised learning as regression. So in this example, the data points X and the labels Y are both just one-dimensional real coordinates. And all we're trying to do in this example is maybe fit some function, such as maybe this blue curve, to describe our data. And of course, there's lots of subtleties involved with fitting, overfitting, underfitting, that we have to consider. And those problems also carry over when we talk about machine learning more generally. If we have a case where our labels are discrete, we call this class of problems classification. And so a very famous example that a lot of people start with when they're first doing supervised learning is classifying handwritten digits. So there's a huge database of handwritten digits that I think were written by teenagers that you can look up. It's the MNIST database of handwritten samples. So here's just four of them here. So ideally what we would like when we design a machine learning algorithm is that for this first picture, we would get out the label 5. For the second one, we would get 0, et cetera. So those would be the ideal labels. And there's lots of people online that try to get the highest possible accuracy they can on this data set. And I think you can get well over 99% accuracy with some of the best neural networks that are out there. OK, so now I've talked to you a little bit about supervised learning, which is what we're trying to do. Now I want to tell you a little bit about how we're going to do it today. So we're going to do this using neural networks. And so neural networks, if you look in papers about machine learning, you'll see lots of different pictures. These are just four examples of neural networks in kind of recent papers. So of course, they're all different, and they're doing different things. They're implemented in different ways. Some of them are for supervised learning. Some are for unsupervised learning. But definitely, there's some things in common. There's like some circles or squares or cubes and lines connecting them. And so I think by the end of today, hopefully, you'll kind of have an idea, at least, of what's going on within these kind of pictures. So this is just one example of a feed-forward neural network that can be used for supervised learning. So information in these diagrams flows from left to right. And to kind of put this in terms of the definition of supervised learning that I showed you, the input is this leftmost yellow layer here in this example. And then the function that we want to fit to this data can be represented kind of by this whole box, which is most of the network. And then the output is what comes out the end of this function. And now we can kind of develop a little bit of terminology and some labeling here. So we tend to label the layers from left to right, starting with 0 for the input layer. And in this case, we would say the network has 3 layers. We call the first one the input layer. Then we have one, we can have hidden layers. And then we have an output layer. And the number of layers that we have and the number of these circles that we have in the intermediate layers, this is all something we can play with and adjust. And as we're going to see in the tutorial, how you design these layers can have a fairly big impact on the accuracy of the resulting system. So to kind of give you the mathematical structure of how this works, I've kind of zoomed in on just one of these circles. So we call these circles neurons. So if I've just kind of picked one in the layer L, and it's the, if I start labeling them 1, 2, 3, et cetera, from the top, this is the jth neuron. So you'll see, if I go back to this picture here, for each circle, there's lines going into it from the left and lines from the right. Okay, so actually, every output coming out of here is the same. So the neurons all pass the same output onto the next layer of the network. And it takes input from all of the neurons in the previous layer. And then just some notation that we should introduce. When I use this variable n, it's just talking about the number of neurons in layer n. So here, it means the number of neurons in the previous layer. And capital L is going to be the total number of layers. So it was 3 in the example in the previous slide. And then with that notation and definition, the output from a neuron can then be written like this. So there's a few key pieces here. There's a nonlinear activation function that we have to choose. I'm going to show you some common choices of that. And then as input, it takes some linear combination of the outputs from the previous layer. So on every link of this network, we have to define a weight and a bias for every neuron. This is just something you'll see in the code, that this total argument we might refer to as Z. And what we really mean when we say that the network is learning is that we're adjusting the weights and the biases. So we want these to reach some optimal value so that our network is going to offer a good representation of the labels that we're trying to reconstruct. So again, the weights and biases are tuned throughout the learning process. The activation function is something called a hyperparameter, of which there are many. And that's something that you choose yourself. And you can try different types of activation functions and compare the accuracy. But at a given time when you're training the network, this is not something that changes. Okay, so there's many different choices of how we can have these activation functions applied. And you can also have different activation functions on your different layers or even on your different neurons if you want. So the one that was used historically for a while was the perceptron, which is basically just a step function. And this is kind of the reason for this being used is because it's kind of to be thought of as on or off. So it's 0 means that this neuron is off, it's not firing, and 1 means that yes, it's firing. It's kind of a binary activation function. But it turns out that if you use a perceptron, you'll probably have issues in your training just because we rely on taking gradients of these functions. And of course, we'll have discontinuities when we do that if we have something like a perceptron. So some of these other options are more common. So I think in the code that I'm going to give you today, we're going to start with a sigmoid activation function. But I'll let you guys try adding in something else. I think I'm going to get you to add in the ReLU function, which is called a restricted linear unit. So it's linear for positive input, and it's 0 for it's 0 below that. And even though this is going to have a discontinuity exactly at 0 and flat gradients here, it turns out that it actually works quite well because it doesn't have quite all the same problems as the perceptron. So I've kind of given you guys some activation functions that you can try adjusting in the tutorial, but you're very welcome to try some other ones from these six or other ones that you might want to try as well. And then another thing that we need to choose is how we're going to measure how well that our network is performing. So to do this, we use something called a cost function. So again, as I said before, our goal is to find weights and biases in our network such that if x is our input, then the output is going to be f of x. We want that f of x to be close to the known label, which is y. So our cost function should measure in some way how well we're doing at accomplishing this goal. And of course, there's different ways that we can do that. But what we should have is that when the output is close to y, this function should be a minimum. And so a very simple way to do that is to just sum the mean squared error over all of our neurons and all of our data points. That's the mean squared error cost function. We can also use something called the cross entropy, as long as our output is between 0 and 1 so that it can be interpreted as a probability, then a cross entropy is something else that we can use. And again, this is another hyperparameter that I'll let you play with in the tutorial. And you can just see it'll affect your performance, how you're going to measure the error in this case. So sometimes you have to try some different cost functions, different activation functions. But of course, our goal, no matter what cost function that we choose, is to minimize this cost function over all the possible weights and biases in all of our layers. So we should have that the gradient of our cost function with respect to any parameter in our network, so any weight or any bias, is zero. But our networks can become very, very big. So of course, solving this problem exactly is very difficult. So that's why we also need to choose a certain type of optimization problem to approximate how we're going to solve this. So the one that we're going to use today is kind of the most simple algorithm, which is called gradient descent. So this is basically just making adjustments in our weights and biases in some steps that are proportional to the gradients. And the step size is yet another hyperparameter that we have to choose. That's called the learning rate, so this eta parameter. This kind of controls how much of a step we're going to take towards the minimum of the cost function with respect to that parameter. So you can show that if this learning rate is small enough, then of course you're always going to approach some kind of a local minimum in your cost function. But there's other algorithms that are a little bit more sophisticated that you can play with as well. So stochastic gradient descent, this makes use of some randomness, and it also is a little bit faster. So this will just look at some of your data samples instead of all of them. And this is, in many cases, performs better than just gradient descent. And then there's more advanced algorithms as well that if you look at some of those resources I give you, they'll kind of explain how these different learning algorithms perform compared to just simple gradient descent. But the TensorFlow library has a lot of these implemented, so you can definitely implement them yourself. But for today, it's nice that we can just use this TensorFlow library and we can try different learning algorithms, different activation functions in quite a straightforward way. Okay, so that was a really fast, I think, overview of neural networks and how they work, how the structure is, how we train them. I wanted to leave time for us to work on the tutorial and kind of talk about how that works. So, but does anyone have questions up until here? No? Okay, so the next thing you'll need is you'll need to go to this website that Eric has put on the board. I've also put it here, but it's a very long link. And so there's a few steps you'll need to follow to open this notebook. And then once everyone has it open, I'll just talk about a few things together. So you'll go to this link. And at the top, there should be unless you've used Google Collaboratory before, by default, it's not going to look very nice. But there should be an option at the top asking how you want to open it. and you're going to choose Open with Google Collaboratory, then in order to actually make changes and run the cells, you're going to need to open in Playground. And then if you want to save it for yourself so that you can continue working on this in your own time, you need to choose the option Copy to Drive. Once you've done all of that, you should get something like this. So the title should be Copy of this notebook. And then you should actually be able to run the cells. There should be a little play button that you can run. So I'm going to give you guys just a couple minutes to see if that works, and just let me know if you run into any issues. But usually this works quite well. So
didn't work for me earlier. I just updated the link. Maybe I hope it works now.
Ah, okay.
So you might
Let's
need
see.
To reload the web page. This is what I'm getting.
Yeah, so then open with here.
Ah, very good.
But then you probably need to do connect more apps. Sometimes you need to do that, sometimes you don't.
Okay.
And then just put collaboratory, C-O-L-A-B. Yeah, and then connect.
Oh, wow, okay.
And now you should be able to click this. Great,
okay.
And then yeah, the open here. And
open
then and then you save a copy. Yeah, and that should be it. So doing this for
let me repeat.
Sure.
A bit more complicated. So you go to that URL, and then in the title bar there is the long URL, I mean the one up there. You click on it, and then what happens to me? There is a page full of garbage that appears. That's apparently as it's supposed to be. And then open, there's a tiny link, open with, and then you click on there, and then you go to connect more apps on there, and then a window opens, and then you type collab, enter, and then you can look for collaboratory, you can connect to that, then you can open with the collaboratory, and then you're close to that page, but not almost.
I should also say, depending on your browser, sometimes you have to do that step, and sometimes you don't, the connect more apps. Yeah, but if anyone, just let me know if you're getting stuff.
Okay, I'll walk through them.
Yeah, that's great, yeah.
And see whether you're
stuck. Can you just say it again slower, most people.
Okay, so you click on that link on the page, and then you see a page with garbage that is exactly like that, and then that's opened with here. There is no
open with. Reload, because the Dropbox link is old. Refresh the page, it'll have the Google Drive page.
Okay. Lauren, there's no open with.
Let's see. Okay.
Sign in.
Sign in.
It didn't show up until I signed into my Google account.
Oh, yes. Oh, very yeah. Good. And then open with. And then connect more apps. And then you type Cola, C-O-L-A-B. Let me spell it on purpose to be funny.
Without
no, only
an
one L.
Only one
C-O-L-A-B.
L.
C-O-L-A-B. So it's going to misspell it on purpose.
Yeah.
And then,
and then connect.
Connect the app.
And then open with. And then open in Playground. And then save to Drive. Okay. Yes, I'll walk around to make sure everybody gets there.
Yeah.
Anybody have questions about getting it open?
Sorry about that.
It's spelled with only, I just overheard you, it's only spelled with one L, C-O-L. I don't think so. I think I don't know why they like chose to spell it wrong. There you go. Yeah, it is very confusing.
Yeah, I just did it a different way, but it works.
Oh, you don't use the collaborative. Okay. Very
no.
Good.
Yeah. I did not press this. How do I go back to the text mode?
To what text mode?
Yeah, it was text, and I did something, and then boom, this. Like, how do we?
Excel, or maybe they do. Can you help out? It's a Jupyter Hub question.
potentially.
How's it going?
Oh, I was doing like usually foreground, but then I did something.
Oh, no. Oh, so you're going to use TensorFlow, yeah. I know. This is why I use this, because like otherwise you spend the whole session just installing, and I like, and I don't know. I mean, there's, it's so different on every computer. It's so annoying. So like,
I assume that, you know, Anna can work for everything. It's like, Honda installs TensorFlow. Sorry, I can't do that.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's a nightmare.
What is the best that coffee teacher?
So you should, I think it's here, open in Playground, because otherwise you won't be able to actually run it. And then you probably, probably says copy to drive, like one of these things.
Yeah, the Google Drive.
Just because then you'll be able to, if you want to open it again later, it'll actually save to your Google Drive.
So
yeah.
Here.
Yeah, and this probably says copy or something, or?
Yeah.
So now if you go on your Google Drive, there should be a copy of it, yeah.
You still have to click 15 buttons.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not simple enough.
Yeah, no. But now you need to get an account in collaborative. Why?
Yeah. Does anybody, how many people have this installed already or have this page open? Okay, almost every, oh, great. Okay, I think that's everyone. Good. Okay.
If anyone has problems, just call up. I'll be happy to go there and try to fix it.
Yeah. So I'm gonna now open.
Okay.
I'm gonna now open my. Okay, so now you guys can see this is, just to go through the steps, just in case anyone is still not having this open. For me, I already have this Google Collaboratory connected. And actually for me, when I used Chrome from my Mac, it was always like this. I never had to go to connect more apps, but I know some people did have to. So then I just did open with Google Collaboratory. And then, right now, if I try to run these cells, you can only look at them. You won't actually be able to run them. So that's why you need to go open in Playground. Now you're going to be able to run everything, but it won't save your own copy. So you might want to work on this a little bit later after you close it. So it's a good idea to copy to drive. And maybe I'll actually just take a second to show you where it saves. So for me, if I go to Google Drive and I just go to my Drive, then there's a folder called Colab Notebooks. Oh, sorry, this is not showing on your screen. I'm like narrating it as I look at my screen, but it's not showing. Sorry. So let me add a new thing here. Here we go. Okay, I'll leave them both up there for a second. Actually, no, let's find this one for a second. So if I'm in my Google Drive, there should be a folder automatically created called Colab Notebooks. And it, see right here, you can see copy of feedforward neural networks TensorFlow. So that's where it's going to be saved. So if you want to open it again later, that's where it will be. Okay, so let me go back now. If you have questions about that, just let me know. I'll put this back. Okay, so again, feel free to let me know if there's any issues with this. But now you should find, if you start here, what this first cell is doing is it's generating a data set. So if everybody just clicks on this play button here, you should get something like this popping up. How many people get that when they run it? Okay, I'm gonna give it a couple of seconds because not everybody has it yet. Might take a second, but. Okay, how many people have this popping up now? raise your hand again, even if you did before. Okay, I think that's almost everyone. So I just want to talk a little bit about what the problem is today. Then I'm going to give you guys some time to work on this, and then I'll come back and kind of go through a few of the solutions. But I think it's nice to kind of try it and probably refer back to those slides to just see the notation. And then we can come back and try and talk about this. So what the data set is in this case is the data points are just two-dimensional coordinates, so x1 and x2. And our label in this case corresponds to the color in this picture. So in this case, I have three possible labels, 0, 1, and 2. And those are kind of indexing what branch I want to label this data as being part of. And what we want to do is have our network be able to learn what branch something is in based on the x and y data points. So the first exercise, what I want you guys to do is just, you're going to just run this block. So actually the first thing you're doing is not even changing anything. And if you scroll all the way down to the bottom, you should see this image that keeps flashing, updating. And so what you're seeing here is it's showing you how it's trying to classify this space. So you can see that right now it's just trying to classify all the space using lines. It's not really doing a very good job. So actually the accuracy here on this data set that I've given it is right around 50%. And this cost function that we're trying to minimize, it's just flat. It's not really making progress. So what I want you guys to kind of do is make some various improvements to your network and try to understand what the neural network is that it starts with and what it's going to look like after we make some improvements to it. So kind of go back to those slides that I showed you and try to understand what the architecture is of the system we start with and what it's going to be after you kind of change the hidden layers in the network. So I'll let you guys start, and maybe after a few minutes we'll kind of talk about exercises 2 and 3, but maybe give those first few a try. And of course, if you get those done, continue to go through. I've given you a lot of exercises. I think there's probably way too many for the time period today, but just for those of you that want to continue exploring after this session, I just wanted to give you a lot of things to think about. But I think even going through the first three exercises is a pretty good introduction to TensorFlow and how it works. So I haven't really given you guys too much of an introduction to the various functions in TensorFlow. That's because I think everything that you need to know for the most part is here. And I think I tend to find it works pretty well for people to learn by modifying the code that's already there. Maybe there's a few functions that you can look up, but they're going to be very similar to things that are already here. So let me know if that's not the case. If you find it confusing, we can definitely go over some sections. But I've tried to put a lot of comments to explain what things are doing. And make it clear which sections you need to modify. Do you guys have questions? Okay, so I'm gonna let you guys work on that for a little bit. I'll come around, just let me know if you have questions, and then we'll talk again about some of that, the answers to some of those exercises in a bit. Okay guys, so I think maybe let's talk a little bit, because maybe I should also say that I wanted to get to the point where we could look at this example. Normally when I teach the machine learning course from Anybody Physics as part of the PSI program, I do this example in our first tutorial. But before doing that, we actually do two full lectures. And so I kind of tried to compress those lectures to the point where we could actually solve some problems today. So sorry if it's maybe a little bit fast. I want to just start by maybe just talking a little bit more about what we're doing in this example and maybe try to understand exercise 2. So how many people think that they know the answer to exercise 2? Just kind of like reading through the code and figuring out what neural network corresponds to what's in the code. Has anyone thought? Some people are like so-so with that. Okay, so maybe let's talk about it. I'll maybe erase the board. Okay, so the first thing that we have in a neural network is we have an input layer. So this is the one on the very left of our network. And again, information flows from left to right. So let's just think about our input layer in this case. So what data are we giving as input? So we're trying to classify data points in terms of what branch they're in. So can somebody tell me what the input would look like or something about the input? How many neurons I should have? The number of neurons is kind of the dimensionality of your data. So in this case, how many dimensions is my data?
Two.
Two, exactly. So the first layer, this is the input layer. So the input layer in this case is just going to be my x1 and x2 coordinates. So that's literally what's going in to the network. If I'm talking about a single data point, what I'm putting in there is the number that's x1 and the number that's x2. So let's go through the part of the code where I said to look through the defining the architecture. So I actually kind of told you here that I just wrote layer one to comment this. So I'm defining some set of weights that I'm calling W1 for this first layer, some sets of biases, Z1, if you remember from the definition that was back in the slides, that just comes from doing some matrix operations with my weights and biases and my input. And then A1 is the output from that first layer. And then in this case, the network output is just from that first layer. So we actually only have one layer in this network. It's not deep at all. So, so let's try to figure out if I'm putting a single data point through here, I'm only going to have one layer. So there's going to just be zero hidden layers and just an output layer right away. But is someone able to tell me how many neurons I would have in this output layer? I see some fingers up. Yeah. Okay. No one wants to say it out loud, but I'm seeing some threes. So yeah, that's right. In this case, it's just three because we have three branches. In general, in this code, all you have to do to change the number of branches is change this k parameter. So it's k by default, but you could modify that. So let's actually just draw the more general version, which would be k branches. Y1. Y2 up to yk. In this case, it's three, but it could be more. And then we have connections between all of these guys. So this is what I was looking for exercise two. Another way to write this, I shouldn't write y here. Sorry, y is what we hope the output will be, but what the output actually is A. So this is just using the notation that I showed you. And what we really want, if the network is doing a good job, is that this output would be close to those y labels. So this is what my network gives me. And then when I compute my cost function, I compare that output with the actual labels on each neuron. Yeah, question?
Where do you define the length of the last layer of the output layer?
Here, this.
In the code.
Yeah, in the code, but you mean where do I define like the k length in the code? Yeah. So let's look here. So here you can see that, so for the first place we need it is in how many weights we're going to have, because the weight matrix is going to be 2 by k in this case. So you can see here the size of this weight variable is 2 by k, so a k appears here. Same with the biases, the number of bias here is k, so that shows you there. So those are the main places where you'll see it. And then the output of this network is just defined from doing matrix operations from the input, which is two-dimensional, with those matrices that have that k dimension. Other questions? Okay, so let's, the next part, what I was asking you guys to do, because this doesn't actually work very well, right? So in this case, all that I've done is I've said that the output from this layer is just going to come from applying one layer and then one activation function. But clearly, from our output, we see that this is not very successful. So to just kind of reiterate what it's measuring here, the cost function comes from averaging over all of my data points and summing over the output from every neuron. And you can see that this is just flat. It's really not improving. So the actual number of this cost is maybe not so interesting. The point that I want to make is that it's actually flat. That's the important thing I want you guys to take away. And then the other thing that we're doing in this example, we know what the branch is supposed to be, so we can compute the accuracy, and it happens to be getting around 50%, which I think makes sense, because if we look back, if we look at the yellow branch, for example, you can see that for all of these points here, they're going to be classified as being in the blue branch, but really they're yellow. Then these ones, which is, I guess, about half of them, these are going to be classified correctly, and then these ones here are getting classified as purple. So ideally, these separation boundaries would have kind of a curve to them, so that this accuracy, maybe it's not going to be 100% because we have some noise in our data. If we got 100%, we might actually be overfitting, but we can probably do better than 50%, I think. Yeah?
I'm kind of confused. So like, does this mean that we classify like X1 and X2 differently? Like, you would say that they're, like, you would do it separately and then like bring them together? Yeah, like, it seems like you would want to classify the point with both of its coordinates, but the way that you draw the network makes it seem like, I don't know.
I see. Okay, so yeah, let's talk about the output a little bit more. So actually, no, it's the way you're thinking of it that you're saying is intuitive to you is the right way. So it is taking both of them. So first thing to notice, when you look at one of these neurons, it's taking input from both of these data points, right? So you can see X1 and X2 are both feeding in here, here, and here, right? Okay, so definitely that's the case. Now let's talk about what these outputs actually mean. So actually, this code has normalized the outputs in a way that each of these outputs is going to be a number between 0 and 1, and they're going to sum up to 1. So, for example, maybe one time I pass through here, maybe let's say k equals 3, and let's say that I get this output. What would this mean? What do you think this would mean? If I got an output of 0.1, 0.15, and 0.75. Yeah, it would mean, like, maybe I could say it's like 75% sure that X1, X2 is in branch K, right? Or branch 3 in this example, right? But in order to do that, it did rely on taking input from everything, from both of those data points to do that. So when I kind of talked about earlier on, this one hot representation, that's kind of what I'm explaining. I'm saying that the first neuron is going to output how sure you are that this data point is in branch 1. The second number is how sure you are that it's in branch 2, and et cetera, et cetera. What other questions do you guys have? These are good questions. So maybe let's talk then about what I'm asking you to try to do. So exercise 3 is to add in a hidden layer. So if you go back to this picture I showed you in the slides of a neural network, we always have an input layer and an output layer, and we can choose to have hidden layers. And the hidden layers have properties that we design ourselves. So let's, maybe I'll move this. Okay, so now let's just talk about what it will look like in terms of a picture if I add in a hidden layer. So if I do that, I'm not changing anything about my actual data. So the input and the output layer should be the same. And then somewhere, this is gonna be a L1. Where L just corresponds to how many layers that it's gone through. So this is gonna still be my output layer. It's gonna look, it's gonna have the same number of neurons as it did before. But now I've asked you to add in a hidden layer with 4 neurons. So that just means you're gonna have 1 layer in the middle. So you're gonna have 1 hidden layer. So this means 2 layers in total. So L, capital L, is going to be equal to 2 in this case. And again, in these examples that we're doing, everything is connected to everything else. So the network would look like this. So the next challenge is, of course, how do I actually modify the code so that this happens? But this is at least what it looks like schematically. Do you guys have questions about that? Okay, so that's kind of the answer to, I guess, which numbers was it? The second exercise and the third exercise. But the third exercise, of course, you still want to kind of add that neuron in the code. So should I give you guys a couple minutes to try doing that in the code and then we go over it? Or do you guys want me, what? How many people would like a bit of time to kind of try looking through the code? Okay, how many people want me to kind of just like talk through the solutions?
Can you just,
yeah,
about the shape of the matrix when you're doing the modification stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, let's do that. Yeah. So let's go back to this top example then.
I mean, in terms of how the shape goes.
How the shape of the matrix is in TensorFlow? Yeah. So are you talking about the weight matrices?
Oh, when you do the multiplication, right? Why do you do x times W1 or something?
Are you talking about here, this line here?
I know, I'm saying, supposing, I mean, adding up one layer, right? What should be the shape of all those new variables?
Okay, so maybe let's go back to the slides to talk about that. Let me. Okay, so let's go back here where I define this equation, and I'll just write this down so that we have it on the board. Okay, so I've just copied this down, and then I'll go to this picture here. Okay, so let's talk about what this is. So let's start with the exercise B. So my input X is X is some two-dimensional vector, right?
Yeah, that's okay. You're supposed to X is a placeholder with null and two, right?
Oh, you're wanting to know okay, so you don't want to actually know the dimensions of the variables you want. Okay.
Yeah, but just what happens in the test.
Okay.
Always got a problem.
Okay, let's go through that. Okay, so let's maybe just walk through some of these lines and we'll talk about them. So some of this is just specific syntax of TensorFlow. So placeholder, when we say placeholder, what we really mean is that we're going to give some data and we're telling you that it's going to be two-dimensional. The reason it says none is because we haven't specified yet how many data points we're going to put in there. So we're saying this is a placeholder, it doesn't contain any data yet, but I'm just defining that the second dimension is going to be two. And similarly for y, because I haven't actually calculated the output, I can put none here as well. But we do know that there, because we don't know how many data points that we're going to have in the end. Then we go through here, and then our weights and biases are variables. Variables means it's something that can change throughout the training. So that's what that means. And then these Z1 and Z2, these are going to be defined implicitly by doing this matrix multiplication, by going through there. You guys have other questions about that?
So what would be the shape of Z1 in this case?
Of what, sorry?
Of Z1.
Z1 in this case? So Z1 is going to be just a vector, right? Because we've done the matrix multiplication. So Z1 in this case, it should be k-dimensional, I think. But that you should also note that...
It should be non-2 or non-2 or
k-non. It would be if you were to define it, if you were to define it from scratch, but we're not using this placeholder syntax when we do that. Maybe I'll come around and talk to you to speak, unless somebody else has, if you guys all have the same question, but I think you guys are looking at maybe different parts of the code. Yeah, question.
This, the way that neural networks are typically written then seems to be sort of like, have a lot of extraneous information, like this thing that's drawn as four circles is actually just a 4x3 matrix, plus some other stuff that you apply to the outputs, so like somehow you've drawn like inputs per circle, but some. What am I missing?
The circles are the vector. The layer is the connections between. So the 2x4 matrix are the lines between the 2 and the 4 circles.
Yeah, the weights are the lines, and the biases exist kind of on the neurons.
I see.
Yeah. But it is basic. It is matrix multiplication, but with a nonlinear function applied at each layer as well.
So in what sense is that a function applied to sort of, say, two inputs on the neuron in the middle layer?
In this layer, how is it considering two inputs?
Yes.
Okay, so my weight matrix in this case is going to be two-dimensional by four-dimensional, 2x4. So this here...
It's the matrix then, right? That's what I'm saying. That's...
The lines are basically representing a matrix, yeah. So it's like I take this input... The lines mean that I do some matrix multiplication, which is like a 2x4 matrix in this case. And then I add the bias, I apply a nonlinear function. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
The problem is that I see the picture and I think my tensor network and it's exactly different than that.
yes, it is.
That's right.
It's not as rigorous. That's the problem.
It's like the dual graph of tensor network.
But as a tensor network, this would be just two circles and then three lines in between. It's trivial.
It's exercise two, I tried to draw a picture, I drew two circles there.
Oh, so what would, if you're using tensor network intuition, what would you answer for exercise two? Just two circles, and that's it.
Do one circle. Output.
Oh. Oh, I see. Because in tensor networks, it's like you would have one line going in and one line coming out.
Circle is the matrix.
I see. I see. Yeah. Yeah. So I do find that often when people learn this notation, they realize like, oh, this diagram looks so complicated, but it's really, it's just a series of matrices and nonlinear functions being applied.
It's because you're supposed to think like a biologist. Like those are the circles are cells.
Yeah.
And the connections are like synapses between cells, like neurons. And then basically like the rule is each neuron gets a bunch of inputs and it,
yeah.
if the inputs are telling it that it's on a certain level, it fires.
Yeah.
And then when it fires,
right.
it's an output. To,
yeah. And I think you're absolutely right that it does come from intuition of like biologists or neuroscientists, right? Because I find often when I present this to physicists and I tell them about this like firing or not firing with this perceptron, physicists always react by saying, like, that's so stupid. Why would you use this discontinuous function? But if you are thinking more in terms of, like, intuition from the brain and neurons firing, it is maybe more intuitive to think of it as a binary thing. But, yeah, maybe physicists find this less intuitive. That's a good point. Yeah.
So, and related to that, a second question, which is that so working through these exercises, I have heard from people who are doing neuroscience simulations, this kind of stuff, that this ReLU is often the best thing to use. But
yeah.
In these exercises, it seems very ineffective.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I don't remember. I think, so, okay. First of all, I wouldn't necessarily make that conclusion just by changing it once because there's lots of hyperparameters here, right? You can also change the learning rate. I know in this example, changing the learning rate has a big effect. So it starts off as one in this code, but if you reduce it a little bit, that can make a big change. So it's, so I know in this example, maybe it's not necessarily a lot better than the sigmoid, but I don't think it should be much worse. It might be worse if you do it on the output layer, but if you do it on the intermediate layer, I think that it should still make sense, at least the result. It should be comparable if you adjust the other hyperparameters too.
Is it common to use different sort of activation functions on different layers?
Yeah, all of these are things that you can play around with. I think from what I have seen, it's maybe not as common to use it on the output layer because we're more wanting to interpret the output layer as a probability. So we'll always kind of reapply some normalization. I tend to see people using sigmoids on the end, but that doesn't mean you can't use it and then apply some normalization after. You can try that as well. But actually, I think people were quite surprised that ReLUs have worked so well, but they tend to be very successful in a lot of applications. But at least, so... Again, I just want to emphasize one thing, which is that I've given a lot of exercises here, but this is really more just because I've thought of them before, and it's not at all because I think this is something you could get through in this amount of time. I think just getting through up to exercise three is kind of giving you a basic introduction to TensorFlow, which is what I was aiming to do today. And again, I hope you can appreciate that there's lots of hyperparameters in these networks, and this is a non-trivial problem, which I think is basically what you were pointing out just now, that there's a lot of factors that you need to adjust. Some of them we adjust in a smart way, like the weights and biases, but a lot of them, at least in this code, we don't, right? So you can see that it's we can't just say, like, go and learn. We also kind of have to help it, right, in this code, at least. Yeah.
Is there any intuition for why the two-neuron network ends up with boundaries between the different sections that are just lines? Is it just because a line is defined by two parameters and there's only so many degrees?
Yeah, I was trying to think about that at one point. I think because in this case, we're doing basically just a linear transformation, and then we do something nonlinear at the end, but then we just renormalize it. So I think basically the effect is the same as not even applying that nonlinear transformation. I think we're basically just doing something linear in the end. So you can also play with like adding more hidden layers, and you'll see that like the shapes that it gets are much more advanced as it has more and more layers. This is not even necessarily a good thing because at some point it's overfitting. But yeah, as if you have fewer layers, especially in this example, it's gonna just be this like linear classification, and it gets crazier as you add more. Yeah. That just reminds me of something I wanted to mention, which is just that measuring whether you're overfitting is another really important thing to do in this type of thing, which I didn't talk about in this set, but a lot of these references I've given you, they talk a lot about this. So definitely wouldn't want to just add, you know, hundreds of layers with hundreds of neurons and have it fit every data point, because we know it would be fitting noise, right? So just to be aware that this, I'm not going to talk about it because we don't really have time, but this is something really important to be aware of when you're actually working with this stuff. Yeah.
Is there sort of like a science to picking, you know, the number of layers and neurons, or is it just sort of like a grid search sort of thing, or?
Yeah, I mean.
Efficient way to do that, or just kind of.
I think it's, well, there's no like definitive rules. People do different studies of varying certain hyperparameters, and maybe people have found that under certain situations, some things are good, but there's no, I can't give you like a specific rule for how to choose them. This is like part of a big part of the challenge of these systems. I don't know if someone else maybe wants to chime in about that, maybe.
Nobody
yeah.
will publish such a thing because it will destroy like a million good jobs.
Sure,
they'll be murdered by their colleagues.
But I mean, this is kind of like meta machine learning, I guess. If you want to do machine learning to tune your hyperparameters, right, then that introduces more hyperparameters. So like there's, you can always try to do something smart, but then that can maybe introduce more degrees of freedom in your algorithms as well. So. Yeah, another question.
Yeah.
Sorry, say again?
Can we add the second layer before we run out of time?
Yeah, yeah, because I know, actually, I know there's something else in this room at 2:30, so yeah, we should do it now. Yeah. Let's do that. I'll try to do this using kind of like the same syntax that I had before, so let's go here. And you guys can follow along. Sorry, I'm like getting confused with my own code. Here we go. So here's our layer one. So if we, let me add a variable that's number of hidden layers. So I'll call it NH equals 4. Because in this case, I can easily vary how many. I'm not going to just hard code it as 4. So let's see. The first thing I need to change is the dimension of my weight matrix in that first layer. So right now it's 2 by K. But if I want to add this hidden layer, what should it be now?
2 by 4.
Exactly. Yeah.
Should we adjust the length of it?
Oh, NH.
Switch back to presentation.
So again, I'm putting NH because I introduced this variable, but in this code, it's going to be 4. Same for my biases. I need to modify that. But then I shouldn't need to modify here how I'm calculating Z1 and A1. That's going to just be the same type of matrix multiplication, and it's going to, in a smart way, figure out those new dimensions. So let's now just copy this section because it's going to be similar for layer two. And if you wanted to be more sophisticated, you could, of course, like not just write, you know, W1. You could make this some list of weight matrices or something, but I'm just going to do it this way. So now I want W2, B2, Z2, and A2. So in this case, my weight matrix, what is its dimension going to be in this case? Can someone tell me? I heard some. I just didn't hear what someone said, but someone said something.
4 by 3.
NH by K. Exactly. Yeah. And my bias now, it is going to be K. And then now this is going to be calculated in a different way. So the input here is going to be A1. I want to multiply by W2. And then I want to add the bias, B2. And then I want to apply this output here. Then I've just chosen to define a variable AL, which just means the last output, so that I don't have to modify any code below. So now my output is A2, so I just need to change this here. OK, so let's see. I hope this should work. Let's just see what happens if I just do that modification. There you go. So now you can see that just with that modification, it's doing some non-linear classification. And then, of course, there's many other things I encourage you to try, like modifying the activation functions and the cost functions, exploring what happens as you modify the number of hidden units, for example. I've just told you to put 4, but you don't have to put 4. You could put a different number. Now you can definitely see, too, that the cost is improving. The accuracy, I mean, now it's kind of flattened out, but at least for a while it was improving, whereas before it kind of immediately flattened out. So this is not perfect still, but it's at least a start to improving the network. So the rest of the exercises are just to kind of continue to explore what happens as you vary the different hyperparameters, and to continue to make the network have more flexibility. I'll go back up to the solutions just in case you guys didn't quite get it down. If you guys want to kind of write this down. Any other questions? I'm also happy to chat about this more if anyone wants to talk more. I know I gave you guys a lot of exercises again, but if you want to maybe try them and then let me know if you ever want to talk about it, I'm around. So. Anything else? Okay, well, I'll let you guys keep working and just let me know. I guess I think this room is going to have other people in it in like 5 minutes, but if you guys are going to work for a few minutes, I'll still be here. Thank you.